Hi, I'm Trevor, and welcome to Catching Up on Cinema. If you aren't familiar with the program, Catching Up on Cinema is a film analysis podcast wherein we introduce each other to films, expand our cinematic horizons, and, in essence, catch up on our cinema. So it is the month of April, 2023, and we are in the midst of our Cyber Techno Future Shock month. Essentially, what we're going to be doing from week to week this month is reviewing what I'd like to call techno or cyber thrillers from the early to mid 90s. It's an odd little subgenre that apparently is not especially well known, or more importantly, not especially well beloved by most. But it's one that I have a lot of nostalgia for, largely just because I was a child at the time, and I don't know, these movies jumped out at me quite a lot more. I mean, this was the era where literally all you had to do to sell a movie was deliver the promise of some sort of computer graphics imagery in there. Just some form of CGI, and people would show the fuck up. Because that was the trend at the time. That, as was the style at the time, as I've been saying literally every episode of the show for the past month or so. You may have noticed Kyle is not present for this episode. We had a lot. We both had really tight schedules this week, so it's just going to be me today. And as is the style, when I do these solo reviews, I'm going to use the cast and crew as kind of a branching off point to just kind of say a little something about this movie. Speaking of which, I should probably introduce the movie. The movie I'm going to be talking about today is one that I actually was kind of hyped to talk about, because it, as far as I know, it's not especially well remembered, but it's one that I saw at some point and it made me laugh in really fun ways. Like, it tickled me in kind of just the right way when it comes to the trappings of this particular subgenre. And that movie is Ghost in the Machine. Not Ghost in the Shell, Ghost in the Machine. Which is, it came out in 1993. It's directed by Rachel Talalay, who we'll get to in a second, but came out in 1993, and SEO, search engine optimization, was not really a thing in 1993. And I'll tell you right now, in 2023, not the best title, because you have to dig at least a page deep into Google search results in order to find this movie, because there are far too many other properties that go by the title of Ghost in the Machine. So probably wasn't a problem at the time, although I don't know, looking at these box office figures, maybe it was. But these days, this movie's kind of difficult to come by. In fact, it wasn't available on any streaming service that I'm aware of. I actually had to pay a digital rental fee to watch this movie in 2023. Which I think is unfortunate, because I don't think this is a terrible movie. I think it has just enough fun and nostalgia kitsch to it, 90s nostalgia kitsch, that it's a decent watch. I don't think it's a terrible film, so I'll just go ahead and say that up front. This was very much a me pick, as are seemingly all of the movies this month, because I've actually noticed in conversations, not just with Kyle, but with people around me, like my buddy Brad from the Cinema Speak podcast, and friends of mine, that techno thrillers are not something that I don't think many people give a shit about. There's plenty of people in my social circle who are most certainly aware of them and present for them when they were coming out, like they were alive and conscious in the 90s and whatnot. But I don't think they meant much. Like, they didn't register with them with the same impact as they did for me. So I always had an eye for these kinds of movies. Maybe I was exposed to too many dinosaur VHS tapes with shoddily animated dinosaurs in them, or maybe Beyond the Mind's Eye was thrown in my lap at too early an age or something. I don't know. But this, like, ultra high glossy, untextured polygons, this crappy CGI stuff is very much in my wheelhouse when it comes to things that tickle me in just the right way. And this movie certainly has it. Not in vast quantities, but it most certainly has it. So anyway, just to explain what this movie is, it is called Ghost in the Machine. And actually, let's see, maybe I can find the IMDb plot description, because normally, if you're aware of our show format, Kyle, typically I give him the reins when it comes to giving us a plot rundown, but I'll just read the tagline listed on IMDb. So the tagline is, "Plug into your worst nightmare." But the plot description is, an electric surge causes a serial killer's soul to end up in a computer system. Yes, that is in fact true. That is blunt, straightforward, and to the point. Yeah, that's the plot of this movie. It's a techno thriller by way of a Final Destination style slasher movie. So we have a killer who exists not in the physical form, but somehow he's able to inhabit a electrical signal, and he's able to inhabit and manipulate objects that are controlled via electricity in the kookiest of ways, the most illogical of ways. And that's part of why this movie's fun, is because none of the technology in this movie makes any goddamn sense. And to me, that's always kind of fun, to see filmmakers or script writers play fast and loose with the laws of physics and reality, and just kind of like work from the assumption, basically start from page one when assembling the script with the assumption that, oh, computers can do anything. It's like, hey, kid, I'm a computer. I can do whatever I want. And to me, just it brings back memories of script writing, where the use of the word firewall is just like liberally sprinkled throughout the script whenever things need to get tense or something. It's like, he's using too many firewalls, we can't stop him, or something, when it comes to like hacking or something. Just basically screenwriters who are working from the assumption that, one, they don't know anything about how computers work, and two, more importantly, the audience doesn't know anything about how computers work. But yeah, this is a story of a serial killer who is placed in an MRI machine, and then through shenanigans, I guess, his consciousness is transferred from his body and into the MRI machine. So there's an electrical storm of some sort. It causes his consciousness to end up in the MRI machine. And from there, he joins essentially the electrical grid, and he is able to navigate at will and inhabit electrical instruments to do harm to people. So he continues his serial killing ways. In his case, he is the address book killer. So he takes someone's address book, he steals someone's address book, and he works through it linearly, like alphabetically, and just offs everybody along those lines. So he works his way through people's address books, and basically every kill sequence in this movie, because he doesn't have a physical form, is very similar to like a Final Destination movie would be many years down the line, except he's using electrically controlled appliances and objects to attack people and do nonsensical harm to them. And, you know, the kills aren't super gruesome. There's one that's, like, shockingly gruesome, actually. It's the earliest one, unfortunately. I hate when that happens in like, horror movies, where your first kill is, unfortunately, the very, very best by a long shot. In this case, that is very much the case. None of the other ones really live up to the hype of that one, which is unfortunate. I mean, it is important to kick the door open, like, really put the audience in their place and let them know this is the tone setter. This is what the violence in this movie is going to be. But you never want to do it to such an extent that like people are left wanting for what they saw 40 minutes earlier. And that's unfortunately kind of the case here. In fact, the body count really tapers off. Not a high body count movie. I'll just say that up front. But anyway, that's the movie. conversation over. The director of this film is Rachel Talalay, who I know largely through watching the Elm Street Legacy documentary. It's like a 4-hour documentary about the Nightmare on Elm Street films. And she has a very large presence via interviews in that documentary. And she's a kooky lady. She's a fun interview. She has a really goofy energy about her, and I think she would be the first to admit that she is a goofy lady. Her background in filmmaking, to my knowledge, is largely as a producer, but she has done quite a lot of directing as well. She is, I think, a British and American citizen, as well as maybe Canadian. So she's done a bit of globetrotting, like she's hopped around the world. I think her husband might be British as well. But probably the most important thing about her personal life, I guess, in terms of where she was raised and where she lived, is that she spent a good chunk of time in Balmer. That would be Baltimore, Maryland, where I believe she crossed paths with John Waters. And she would actually go on to produce a number of his films. And I want to say that had a huge impact on her career. I want to say that the two of them had a very strong friendship and bond. In fact, looking at some of these details here, it looks like he officiated her wedding. So they must have been tight. And I want to say that the John Waters connection kind of spills over into her style when it comes to picking film projects and directing film projects. I don't really have the words to describe what I'm getting at here, but I want to say that it's pretty apparent that she's spent a good chunk of her life working with John Waters. They have a really strong connection there. But anyway, as a director, Rachel Talalay only has a few films under her belt. And I want to say, based on the box office returns, maybe she shied away from doing feature film directing because I don't think she has a, quote, successful film under her belt, which is unfortunate. It hasn't, like, killed her momentum as a presence in the film world by any means, but just to list them off, it's a very short list. Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, Nightmare on Elm Street, number 6, I believe. She also wrote the story for that one, generally regarded as not a very good entry in the series, and it was her directing debut, so it kind of sucks that that didn't exactly work out for her, at least from a critical standpoint. But I take that back. Freddy's Dead did, in fact, make money. So she does have a profitable film under her belt. Following that, though, was Ghost in the Machine, and it was not successful. It failed to recoup its budget, and that's not including marketing. Ouch. And then came Tank Girl in 1995, which is kind of a cult film. It's kind of interesting because it's based on a British, like, kind of punk rock comic book that I don't know how much of a cultural footprint it had in the States in 1995. I wasn't exactly reading comics. I was very much aware of comics in 1995. Like all the zeitgeist was something that I was tapped into, but I wasn't actively reading them then. So maybe in like the actual comic book store culture, there was a lot of hype surrounding Tank Girl. I don't actually remember, but it looks like this one cost $25 million and made $6 million. So Tank Girl tanked at the box office. I'm sure some asshole wrote that headline in some publication. I've seen Tank Girl a long time ago. I think it was the TV edit of it, though, so it was probably borderline incomprehensible because that movie does get naughty from time to time. Lori Petty is always fun. She's doing her Lori Petty shit in that movie. Production design is absolutely bonkers. It's very, very early 90s in a 1995 movie. But yeah, it's not good. But I believe it has attained cult status in today's terms. And that looks like she has A Babysitter's Guide to Monster Hunting from 2020, which looks like kind of a family film for Netflix. Netflix doesn't publish their numbers, so I have no idea if it did well or not. But these days, Rachel Talalay is largely a television director, and it looks like she's done some high-profile stuff. Apparently, she's done some very good work on the Doctor Who series. I'll actually have to, for the people who care, I have zero connection to Doctor Who, but somebody out there listening to this hopefully does, because it's one of those franchises that's a huge deal to quite a lot of people under the sun. Peter Capaldi's his tenure on the series. Apparently she did some good work with him. And these days, it looks like she is a fixture on virtually every DC Warner Brothers live action television series. Looks like she has a few episodes of virtually all of those that exist today. And trust me, if you're not paying attention, I'm not. There's a lot of them. So yeah, seems like she's working. She's doing stuff. It's just not feature films. But moving on to the cast, we have Karen Allen here, who I've always been a big fan of. I haven't seen a huge number of her movies, but I know her best. A lot of people know her best as a Marion from the Indiana Jones films. Kind of unfortunate that Crystal Skull exists, but it does. But she has a wonderful screen presence. She's a great actress in a lot of ways. I really enjoyed watching the making of footage of some of those Indiana Jones movies and seeing her and Harrison Ford kind of bounce off of each other in rehearsals and try to like work their way through the scene, especially in Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was really interesting because she was young and she was also largely a stage actress at that point in her career. So she would be the first to admit that she felt like she was thrown kind of in the deep end in that movie. But obviously she persevered. And it's actually kind of funny because she has a connection with two of the young actors in this film in that she is Mrs. Smalls, the mom. Unfortunately, Karen Allen has the distinction of kind of having a similar career path to, like, say, a Dee Wallace, in that she wasn't America's mom. She was more like America's aunt, in that Dee Wallace probably, you know, eclipsed her in that category. But she did play quite a lot of moms in her day. But she played Mrs. Smalls in The Sandlot. And two of the young boys in this movie actually were in The Sandlot. I don't know if she had scenes acting opposite them, but that's a really fun acting connection. And in fact, one of those boys also headlined a Wes Craven film, who Rachel Talalay, working with New Line for so many years, more than likely also had a relationship with, like a working relationship with. So connections, revolutions. You'll find, dear listener, that is the film world. It's all connections and it's all handshakes. It's all relationships. Everybody is connected. Like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon is a really easy game in the film world for virtually every personality in the industry. Yeah, Karen Allen is kind of our protagonist in this. She is the woman from whom the address book is stolen from by the address book killer in this movie. So it's her address book that is taken just prior to him getting in a car accident and having his consciousness transferred into the MRI machine afterwards. So it's people that she's personally connected with that the killer is attacking throughout the movie. So she's kind of the victim, kind of the main character. She has, unfortunately, very little to do in this movie. It kind of sucks. I do like some of her exchanges with her son, though, because she gets to break out some of that Karen Allen spunk. She's pretty good at dropping the hammer when it comes to 90s momming, 90s single momming, by the way. In addition to her, we also have Chris Mulkey, who is one of those that guys. I hate to say it, but he's a that guy to me, where his face is instantly recognizable. His name, not so much. But this guy is a working fucking actor. He works on fucking. I can't think of many films that he like headlined, like where he was the selling point. And I think that's kind of his lot in life as an actor, is that he's not the guy you put loud and proud on the poster as a means of putting asses in seats. But goddamn, can he just support a cast? He is a supporting cast member, and he is an ace when it comes to that category of acting. Because this man's filmography is so, so incredibly dense. Seriously, you should take a look at it. It's deeply impressive. And he puts in a great effort in this one. He's very charming. He turns on the charm, and he brings the energy when it's warranted. He has a little bit of a flirty energy between him and Karen Allen that is recognizable, and it adds a little something to the proceedings that, you know, makes it prevents it from being dull as dishwater. And also he just has kind of an effortless just affability about him. He can also be pretty intense. I've seen him do that in other roles, but here he's meant to be pretty warm and affable. And I'll just say this much. He did a voice role that is kind of important to me, at least in my early childhood, I guess. He is the voice of Shriek in Batman Beyond, which was one of the earlier episodes of that series. And I remember being super hyped for that show. I didn't really escape the first couple of seasons of it. I think one of the only later season episodes that I actually really liked was the Lazarus Pit one. Largely because the old Shirley Walker Batman the Animated Series theme gets played in there, and you get to see young Bruce Wayne, Silver Fox Bruce Wayne in that episode. That was like one of the most hype moments in all of Batman media I can remember. Anyway, tangent aside, Chris Mulkey's a good actor. He turns in a good performance here. Moving on, our killer is played by Ted Marcoux. It's C-O-U-X. I'm sorry, I'm not good with the French, if it is in fact French. He's largely a television actor. I think this may be his only feature film acting role. He did a lot of TV movies and a lot of TV acting in the 90s and the early 2000s. He plays our killer, who is seen on screen for a couple of scenes. We do get a creepy POV segment of him wandering through a family's home after he's killed all four of them. I believe it's two kids and the parents. It's a pretty creepy setup where we see him like pull up to the house on a stormy, rainy night. And then later on, we cut back to that house and we just have this floaty POV shot pacing through the very lovely home. Hideous dinner, by the way. It's like Brussels sprouts and just like macaroni potato mash. Like it looks like something out of a fucking 1970s catalog or something. There's no jello mold on the table, thankfully, but really nasty dinner. Anyway, we then see that he like placed all four of the denizens of that home on the couch, like watching TV with their throats slit. It's pretty grim imagery for a otherwise colorful and stupid fucking movie. But we do get to see this guy, the killer, for a few scenes earlier in the movie. We do find that he works at a computer repair shop or a computer sales locale, and he has a creepy energy about him. I don't know if he's wearing contacts, but he has very, very, very striking blue eyes, which was a good choice. It makes him stand out despite looking kind of incognito. Like he really is kind of an anonymous presence. He's got a funky head shape. He's not very big. He has a creepy voice, but if you were to look at him in a crowd, if he didn't have those baby blues, he probably wouldn't make an impression, which I guess is fairly common when it comes to people that go down this particular path in their life. But yeah, he makes his exit pretty early on via a car crash, and he's like giggling the whole way. His car goes fucking flying off the freeway, down a hill, and through a cemetery. Like, it plows through a couple of headstones, and he's, like, giggling the whole way, and then we discover via a shot, like, a segment that is shot virtually identically to Alex Murphy in RoboCop, in Paul Verhoeven's RoboCop. It's shot and edited very similarly to the sequence where the EMTs are working on Alex Murphy when they have him on the gurney and they're bringing him into the hospital to try to resuscitate him. It's shot very similarly, where the camera is like mounted on the gurney and it's kind of like floaty and disorienting, and there's like people looking down into the camera like it's his eyes and like trying to work on him and stuff. Very intentional, kind of fun though, being as it's like a dark spin on RoboCop, where it's like he's going to be brought back but he's going to be evil, as opposed to super violent but lawful according to the standards of the time. Moving on though, we have Will Horneff, who I just thought of as 90s kid. This kid is 90s as fuck. He is playing happy rap in every scene he's in. He is sagging his pants. He's into computers and video games. He does some of that John Connor shit where he's trying to like con the world or con adults out of money using the power of technology, using a actually it's a combination of two superior film references smashed into one. So we have a sequence where we're introduced to him. The character's name is Josh, by the way, which is an incredibly 90s name. I hate to say it. He is trying to con an adult man out of a finder's fee for a winning lotto ticket. So he claims that he has a winning lotto ticket, but he can't turn it in because he's a minor. And so he basically says, "Hey, dude, I'll give you my winning ticket if I can have like a finder's fee of like $50. And the guy somehow falls for it. And the way they trick him is Josh calls his friend, who's played by Brandon Quinton Adams, and these two boys, Will Horneff and Brandon Quinton Adams. Both of these kids were in The Sandlot, by the way. That's where that connection comes in. His buddy, Fraser, I think is his name. He calls him and he uses a voice modulator plugged into his phone to sound like, I think, an adult woman to make it convincing that he's calling the lottery office or something. And then the con almost works, but then Karen Allen pulls up and part of the kid's sob story to get the guy on his good side was he said like, "Oh yeah, my mom died recently and I'm trying to make my way through life." And then of course mom pulls up and it's like, "Oh, mom's alive and well." So the two references that are coming to mind, again, two superior films being referenced in one fell swoop here, not a good idea, is John Connor from Terminator 2 stealing money from the ATM, and then the talk boy, Kevin McAllister's talk boy, the father. This is Peter McAllister, the father. Credit card, you got it. The voice modulator thing very, very much made me think of the talk boy. So we have two references made in one fell swoop. And yeah, that's kind of this character in a nutshell. Josh is 90s kid. He's a pervert. Very much ingests quite a lot of MTV and Beavis and Butthead. He's into video games and tech. He sags. He's playing happy rap 24/7. He is a little asshole. He is every parent's nightmare, especially single parent's nightmare. By the way, I don't know exactly what Karen Allen's character does as a profession. I think she works at a travel agency. But they got a pool? Shit, she's doing well. Then again, they live in Cleveland. I don't know what... I've been born and raised in Seattle, and I've seen this city grow by leaps and bounds, and I've seen housing prices grow by leaps and bounds. So I don't know what it costs to own a home with a pool in Cleveland in 90s money, but maybe it was more reasonable than it would be out here. Also more sensible, being as our weather is shit. That's Josh and Fraser in one fell swoop. Brandon Quinton Adams, actually, I'll just single out as being, he also was in The Sandlot, but I know him largely from the Mighty Ducks films. But the horror hounds out there, the horror fans, the horror heads, will most likely mostly remember him for being kind of the main character of The People Under the Stairs, speaking of Wes Craven. And also he has a small role in the Michael Jackson headlined film Moonwalker. He plays young Mike in that, and he does a pretty good job with those dance moves. These days, I think his career has cooled down, whereas Will Horneff, the Josh kid, apparently he's a Brazilian jiu-jitsu instructor these days. He owns his own gym, and that's what he does for a living now, as opposed to acting. And there's a couple of small roles here that I'll just rattle off real quick. Richard Schiff pops up in here as a MRI tech. He's in like a couple of shots in the movie. Mostly I just want to point him out because he's Richard Schiff and he's great. And also this movie just happens to be produced by his brother, Paul Schiff. So that's more than likely why he's in this movie for the short time that he is. There's also a couple of smaller roles that I know if Kyle was here, we would probably devote a half an hour to talking about. But I'll try my best to do them justice. So Kyle, if you're listening, this is the part where I try to talk up some of the people that mean a lot to you. Funny enough, he actually came up last week. We were talking about, or a couple of weeks ago, excuse me. We were talking about The Howling. Joe Dante's The Howling. And the subject of Joe Dante's filmography came up, and I was asking Kyle about The Burbs, because Kyle absolutely loves The Burbs. He adores that movie. I haven't seen it in decades, and I only saw a television edit of it. So in some ways, I kind of feel like I haven't seen The Burbs, which is really unfortunate, because knowing how much he loves that movie, it makes me really want to give it its due. So that being said, though, Rick Ducommun, he has a large presence in The Burbs. He is a lovely comedic actor. He just has a he has a particular Canadian delivery to his lines. He has a certain tonality to his voice that instantly makes him affable and instantly makes him stand out in virtually any cast you throw him in. Where even in Die Hard, he has like a couple of lines in that as the DWP guy or whatever. He's just sitting in the manhole, and just that accent in that LA setting, it's like, where are you from? And he's in Spaceballs, he's in Gremlins 2, he shows up in the damnedest of places, but he's always great. I mostly know him for, I believe it's Blank Check. And yeah, Kyle is a big fan of the guy, and it was really funny seeing him pop up in this movie. Kind of unfortunate, though, because as great as he is, he's given very little to do in this, and he's also playing kind of a rigid character. Like, he's playing kind of a tight ass in this, and it's like, why would you cast, like, the goofiest man in the cast as that? And it's like, I guess he's an actor, so he can do whatever you ask him to, but it was unfortunate. I was really looking forward to seeing him cut loose and be really, really funny, but it's just kind of cool to see him. Anyway, yeah, Rick Ducommun is in this movie. And the other one that I have to mention that doesn't, unfortunately, she doesn't like carry a lot of weight with me personally, but again, this is our show. This is both Kyle and I. This is both of our shows, so I need to speak on his behalf here. Jessica Walter has a very small role in this as, quote, grandma. She plays Karen Allen's mother, her doting mother. Jessica Walter has a extensive film and stage body of work. I believe she largely worked in television as a screen actress. Quite a lot of stage work, though, on her resume. But folks out there, if you don't know who I'm talking about, it's probably... you probably have heard this woman's voice, is I guess how I'll put this. I know a lot of people out there are huge fans of Arrested Development. I've never seen an episode of that show, but she was a fixture on that show for as long as it lasted. For me personally, again, she did quite a lot of voice work throughout her tenure as an actor. She and Rick Ducommun have both passed away, unfortunately. I'll just throw that out there in case I forget. I kind of know her as a... I think it was a Fran. I think that was the mama dinosaur in the Dinosaurs TV show. If you remember that Jim Henson show from the 90s. I very much remember that show very fondly. And she did the voice of the mom. But the big one probably for Kyle, among many, many others, because this woman's filmography is incredibly dense, especially in television. The big one for Kyle is probably Archer. I believe she plays Archer's mother in that show, and she did a bang-up job. I don't know if Archer persists to this day, but Kyle loves him some Archer. Such that it's kind of been an annual tradition of sorts that he sends me a Blu-ray of a season of Archer with the expectation that someday in the future, someday, I will be able to understand most of his references. That day has yet to come, but, you know, I'm working on it, bud. I've watched all that you've sent me, so, you know, on to the next. But that's about it for the cast. I will point out that Graham Revell, or Graham Revell, who is a he's a Kiwi. He's a composer from New Zealand. He did the music. He did the score for this film. He's a lovely composer, but unfortunately, some elements of his style, there's a lack of a distinct quality to it, to the point that like I can't point to a single score that comes to mind that I didn't like or that I took issue with for some reason. But at the same time, it's very hard for me to like point to a single one that really like rocked my world and stood out to me as being truly exceptional. He's done really, really good work. Like, for instance, of all things, the Street Fighter movie from 1994 does have a pretty solid score. He has worked with Martin Campbell in the form of No Escape, which is a movie I haven't seen, but I would like to just because I am a big fan of Martin Campbell, and I'd like to cross everything off that list eventually because it isn't very long. Point is, very, very able composer, does good work, but not especially distinct work, if that makes sense. But I will say this much, he does contribute quite a lot to the film just in terms of production value. It's done with a full orchestra as far as I can tell, and it lends it a sense of weight and depth that the movie probably would be lacking for energy if it didn't have that orchestral score backing it. So very, very solid contribution to the film. So anyway, the movie itself, I'm not going to get into too much detail. I already actually laid the foundation for the setup for the story. Serial killer gets in car accident, steals woman's address book just before, gets transported into the techno realm via MRI machine and electrical storm, uses his newfound powers to navigate electrical systems to enter a database and retrieve a digital copy that had been scanned earlier in the movie of that address book. Probably should have deleted that file, by the way, because they did that just in public, like at the computer store when they were doing a tech demo for Karen Allen. It's like, dude, you hung on to that file? Like that's like her personal shit. Anyway, he obtains a digital copy of the address book. And as I said, his MO is to proceed linearly through the address book in the form of a kill list. So I'll actually just talk about that. Let's talk about some of these kills, because that's really mostly all the movie is. It has a really basic pattern to it that's kind of cozy, where it's just nobody knows what's going on for quite a while in the movie. That's maybe one of its weaknesses, is that our characters take a little bit too long to get wise to what's happening. But basically, the pattern is he kills somebody, our characters react to it. The Chris Mulkey character of Bram, by the way, he's a former computer hacker turned computer tech. He works for corporate now, but he has an outlaw past to him, which kind of explains away some of his more radical actions he takes later on in the film. He teams up with Karen Allen to get to the bottom of what's going on, because she is receiving 1993 cyber attacks in the form of her bank accounts being wiped out and some elements of her personal life being affected by her personal records being tampered with in some fashion. So he perceives it as a hacking attack on her by some malicious entity, a human entity working behind a keyboard. But eventually they get to the bottom of it. I forget exactly the solution for that, but the pattern is killer attacks, Karen Allen and her family react in kind, Bram helps them peel back a little bit more of the puzzle, killer attacks again, rinse, repeat. Anyway, our first kill in the movie, as I said much earlier, is most certainly the most impactful and the most grisly by a long shot. And remember, the structure of these kill scenes is very much like, it's set up like a lame Rube Goldberg machine kind of thing, where it does have a Final Destination kind of vibe to it, but it's less about cascading events and more just like teasing certain setups and then swerving as to what the actual payoff's going to be, if that makes sense. So anyway, there's a elderly gentleman who has a nice, he has a fancy home. He's, I think, Karen Allen's boss. We cut to him, and he is rooting through his freezer, and it's chock full of nothing but TV dinners, as was the style at the time. So he pops one into the microwave, and he goes into the other room to connect to the net. So he is hopping online to do some, to look at some porn or something in his office. And while he's doing that, we see Via swooping kind of like miniature photography kind of shots. I'm trying to find the words to describe what these shots look like. So we have a lot of shots, a lot of very cute visual effect shots in this movie where the camera is swooping and gliding, along like power lines and power conduits and ducking into electrical outlets. And it looks like quite a lot of it was shot using miniature photography, and something about the floatiness of it and the motion blur associated with it makes me think of some of like Phil Tippett's work, but more precisely makes me think of some of the miniature sets we saw in Batman Returns, in Tim Burton's Batman Returns, where the Arctic World set, which is displayed to us in miniature form, that the kind of camera maneuvering that we saw in that has a similar vibe to it. Now, I'll say this much, the special effects in this movie, I don't think by the standards of the day, are laughable. Some of them are goofy in concept, but very few of them look outright bad for the standards of the day. And in fact, some of these shots just showing the entity like move through power lines and whatnot and enter the home and like go behind computer screens and peer into people's homes, a lot of that photography I thought was really cool. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the same people who worked on Freddy's Dead worked on these shots, because Freddy's Dead does carry that reputation of being kind of a gnarly looking movie, thanks to the 3D gimmick they had in its final scenes. But some of those like swooping like flesh tunnel sequences, and like the, aside from the shitty CGI worm guys, like some of those shots like flying through the hell tunnels and stuff kind of make me think of some of the shots in this. So good on them. Anyway, the entity enters through his computer and goes into the house, and then ends up in the microwave, and he sets it into overdrive. So it causes the kitchen to start smoking. So the old man, he goes back into the kitchen, and there's a really cool setup, like a kind of a tease as to like what's to come, where the door into his kitchen has a glass pane at eye level, and you can see it has condensation all over it. So it's like, dude, I don't know if that's safe, man. So he goes in there, and it's really hot, obviously, like it's a fucking sauna. But then he touches the microwave, and the door blows open, and like all sorts of smoke and light flashes spill out of it. And then this whole just menagerie of gnarly effects plays out here, where he gets kind of like blown backwards, not like forcibly, but like he's shocked, so he like backpedals into the wall. And then we see like electrical arcs going up and down the cabinets, and we see like grapes shrivel and bananas cream themselves, and just the whole room I think is supposed to be like irradiated, like the microwaves in the microwave are actively spilling out into the room. Or, again, this movie is pretty fucking dumb. You're supposed to use your imagination a little bit, but I think they got the message across that extreme heat and or radiation is pouring out of the microwave into the kitchen, such that his face, his skin starts to boil, like literally just like bubble and pop. And it's really gnarly looking. It looks like I got to use this drop last week, but it looks like he got attacked by millions of bees. Put your gun away. Your weapons are useless against them. Yeah, it looks like he got stung by a bunch of bees, but like really gnarly bees. Anyway, eventually the heat gets the better of him. The heat's gotten to him. Speaking of Batman Returns, The heat gets the better of him, and he passes out, and we see a dummy version of him fall and bonk its head on the table before hitting the ground. And pretty cool last shot is just it's a top-down swirling like shot pushing in on his face, and it's the dummy face, but it still looks pretty gnarly of his face just like completely bubbled and popped and stuff. And there's a pool of blood under his head that is boiling as the camera pushes into it. So he got boiled to death. He got microwaved to death, and it was pretty grisly. That's the scene that I remember the most from this movie, from when I saw it when I was pretty young. But that's kill number one. I think there's a pretty significant gap between kill number one and number two. But the next one, I believe, is one that I actually took it upon myself to post on YouTube a very long time ago, because I remember looking for it because I wanted to show a friend, and I couldn't find it. I was like, oh man, but that was so goofy. Like people need to know about this. So I actually clipped that scene from the movie, and if you look it up on YouTube, you might still be able to find it. I think it's called The Hand Dryer from Hell, is what I called the clip. So this scene is a lot of fun. Basically, there's this schlub that Karen Allen's character is being encouraged to date by her son, mostly because he wants her to leave the house so he can fuck around, you know. This guy, he works at like a crash test. Like he works with crash test dummies. So he must, I don't know, be an engineer or something that works for a car company that we never find out which one. But anyway, he's at the catapult. He's at like the catapult center where they launch the car into the wall and take data, at like impact data, essentially. And he's actually trying to proposition her to like come visit her at the catapult center. And of course, she turns him down. I really like this sequence. It's a lot of fun because it's tedious, I'll admit that. But basically, they do a good job of setting him up as being kind of a prick. And they keep teasing by showing electrical panels lighting up and like instruments queuing up to launch the car. They keep teasing that somehow he is either going to be hit by the car, like it's going to get launched at him, and it's going to take him out at the knees or something, or he's going to somehow get into the car and then it's going to launch into the wall. And they keep doing this thing where like all the panels light up and it gets like the catapult gets taut and it gets ready to launch. And then it just like, you can almost hear the killer, like the ghost in the machine, the titular ghost in the machine. You can almost hear him going, like, just hurry up and just get in front of the car, please. Cause that's, I guess, the frustration of trying to kill people in this fashion, is that you can't actually just reach out and touch them. You got to wait for them to get just right. Or, you know, you can completely cheat physics and reality and just microwave a kitchen made mostly of wood and tile. Yeah, that works. Anyway, they continually tease that the car is going to get flung into him. And eventually he does get into the car because something goes wrong, like in the instrument panels or something. And the car gets launched, finally, after minutes of setup, and there's, like, this like, gap in the action where it's like, what happened to him? Did he get splatted or whatever? Then we discover, oh, wait, you know, it is, you know, the car does have airbags. It is, we are here to test the viability of these safety systems and whatnot, and sure enough, he's not dead. He's shook, like, he's shook up, but he's not harmed. So he's pissed off at everybody. He blames everybody in the room. Like, he just assumes that it's human error or something. And he storms off. And after all those minutes of setup, we, the audience, are like, oh, well, that was kind of an anticlimax. So he goes into the bathroom and he's like washing his face. And he's like, Jesus fucking Christ, that sucked. That was intense. And then somebody's calling him to come back out. And they're like, are you okay? And then there's a hand dryer that operates via a plunger, and you know it's one of those metal hand dryers that has the spout that you can like rotate around, and he turns it upward to dry his face. He hits the plunger, boosh! A jet of flame blows out into his face, sets him alight, and within a couple of seconds he's totally immolated and dead. it's the timing of it is what, like, I'm not doing a good job of explaining it, but essentially, like just the timing of it works as a gag to me. It's like we spent all this time laboring over the setup, and then the punchline is that it's like he just gets got regardless by the dumbest fucking thing you can imagine. And it makes no goddamn sense, but just the timing of it really worked for me. I don't know if it would work for everybody, but to me, I always thought it was really funny. By the way, I did say this movie is 90s as fuck, and does feature super 90s kids in it, kid power. We do actually have a sequence at a mall where the kids are standing on those VR platforms where it has like a, it's like a platform you stand on, but it has this little like guardrail system around your waistline area. And then you wear a helmet and you have a gun in your hand. Now, I never got to do this personally, but I do remember, I think it was my uncle, could be wrong on that, but I know for a fact I went to the mall with my brother, and he got to do this exactly one time as far as I know. I remember there was a time in the early 90s where these things were around, where exactly these rigs were present in like, I don't know if it was in my hometown or if it was in Hawaii when we were visiting relatives, but I actually distinctly remember seeing these around, and I remember my brother getting to do it. So I don't actually know what he saw when he was doing that, but we do have a whole sequence of that, of the two kids going to the mall late at night and playing this game, and then they get stalked in the game by the ghost in the machine. And the graphics during this sequence are not half bad. I mean, we have like, I don't know if you'd call this texture mapping, but we have a situation where it's like these CGI robot bodies with the boys' faces transposed, like stretched across the face of the character in the game. And it's, you know, really basic polygonal geometry and whatnot, like untextured, just like flat, like single colored objects in the cyber realm, but it doesn't look half bad for 1993. It probably looks pretty genuine to the tech used in those games, probably quite a lot better in fact. But it's this cute little sequence where they're being stalked by the ghost in the machine, and he appears as just like a normal person in there, whereas they look all, you know, VR and whatnot. So VR is in this movie. We've had two of those in a row. VR was a fucking thing in the early to mid 90s. It's kind of interesting to see it be such a big deal now, after such a long gap, where I remember when it was this nascent concept that was being teased as the next big thing, and then for several decades or a couple of decades, kind of fucking forgot about it, but it seems like they're the powers that be are making a very big push for it right here and now. So that's maybe one of those thoughts was in the back of my mind, and that's part of why we're doing what we're doing this month with our cyber techno future shock month. But yeah, that sequence was cute. There's also a kind of a scare sequence where the boy Josh is almost drowned in the pool. I did say that the family owns a pool. He's almost drowned because they have a motorized pool cover. By the way, if you have issues with animal like harm coming to dogs, maybe skip this movie. You don't get to see the act of the harm being done. But I will say this much: bad things happen to an animal in this, a dog. So keep that in mind if you're sensitive to that kind of thing. But yeah, there's this sequence where he's like trying to outswim the pool cover as it's going up. And if you have issues with drowning, like if that's something you're genuinely unsettled by, that sequence is decently well executed. I would have like found a way to heighten the tension even more, though. Maybe make the score even more intense or something. It's like 80% there. As far as like skillful execution of a tense sequence like that, like an almost death sequence of sorts. But for what it is, it's not half bad. I think the last death in the movie, actually, only three. Holy shit. I think it's the babysitter who the Josh character has been lusting over. I don't know how old the Josh character is, probably like 13 or 14. He's been trying to like actively hit on the neighbor girl, the babysitter. Because of all the fucking killings, his mom leaves him and his friend with a babysitter, although I believe they're at the friend's house. So this babysitter is looking after the friend's baby sister and the Josh character. And at one point, they pay her $37 and some change to not take off, like, not strip nude, but just, like, flash her underwear at them. And she does it, as was the style at the time. There were a lot of horny boys in the 90s that were buying a lot of movie tickets. So this sort of thing, in the words of Rennie Harlan, I know what teenage boys like. He didn't direct this film, but he did direct a Nightmare on Elm Street movie, and he would approve. He would approve of including this sort of content in your horror film. She gets into it with the boys because there's a little sequence where the baby, they're teasing killing off the baby by I don't think that baby was in the address book. What the fuck? Basically, we have the sequence where the baby is alone in the kitchen, and the production design of this kitchen makes me think almost of the it makes me think of Child's Play 2 a little bit, where it has kind of that like hyper real semi cartoonish vibe to it. Plus, it's a lot of it's shot from like a baby's POV, so the proportions of things feel kind of kooky and cartoonish. Reminded me of Child's Play 2 a little bit. Also reminded me of the opening of Roger Rabbit, with the Roger Rabbit and the baby with the skit in the kitchen. The ghost overboils a pot of milk on the stove. They keep teasing imagery of like sharp objects in the kitchen. That must be why I'm thinking of Roger Rabbit, because not only does it bear a visual similarity to it, also there's that sequence in the Roger Rabbit cartoon where we're shown all the hazards in the kitchen that the baby is totally oblivious to. They do exactly that in the sequence of like showing the knives, and like there's even like an iron. Just like an iron propped up on the kitchen counter or something. There's all these things that could potentially fall and hurt the kid. Anyway, that happens. It's semi-suspenseful. The cute kid, by the way. The babysitter gets hers when she is reading a magazine whilst admiring her reflection in not a mirror, but just like a red pane of some sort. That's, I think it might be the fridge or something. Whilst also watching like in Living Color. Yeah, it was in Living Color. I think it may have been like a Fly Girl sequence or something. So she's multitasking in the 90s. She gets hers in kind of a lame way, if I'm being honest, because it's just too obvious. It doesn't have any swerves to it. Like the other ones have some misdirection, I guess, in particular the car one, but this one it's just the dishwasher gets put into overdrive. I think it has words to indicate the settings, and I'm working from memory here. I think it says agitate when it's like churning. So it starts like going into overdrive and starts leaking suds onto the floor. And then we see there's an extension cord with a loose plug attached to it that's also laying in the kitchen. And we keep cutting back and forth between her and the suds and the cord. And then, it's really obvious, basically, that the dishwasher, I think it goes from agitate to, like, I think it actually says on the display terminate or something, which is, you know, it's cute. Be well, be fucked. the dishwasher spills open, like the door flies open, all the suds spill all over the place. That's going to be a mess. And then the suds contact the exposed cord, like the plug, and then she has her feet in the suds. She's like stands up and then she's electrocuted. It's a bloodless death, decent optical effects, but yeah, it's kind of lame, if I'm being honest. I think that's the last death in the movie. But the whole there is a sequence where grandma gets shot by the cops, which is totally fucked up. Basically, holy shit, the ghost in the machine, he swats the family in this. Talk about being ahead of your time. The Ghost in the Machine swats the family. So the boy, Josh, is living with grandma, and at this point in the story, which is very late in the story, they are aware of how the killer attacks, that he attacks through electrical systems. So they do all sorts of kooky things to block entry to the home via any sort of electrical outlet. So like all the power lines are blocked. They have like Q-tips stuffed into electrical outlets and like electrical tape taped over them. I think they have all the breakers switched off, and they're just like living their lives with torchlight, essentially. Like they have a lantern that they're carrying around. So we have this whole sequence where we see him like frustratedly trying to get into the house and he can't. So what does he do? He swats them. He creates false like police calls. Like he sends in a bunch of police codes for like hostage robbery, assault, all manner of things to get all of Cleveland's police to descend upon the house. And then I forget exactly the shenanigans that cause it, but something goes wrong. And one of the cops, by the way, is played by the fellow who plays Glenn from The Wedding Singer. He's the rookie cop. I believe he made a previous appearance on Catching Up on Cinema in Rockstar. Kyle and I did a review of Rockstar. All the Cleveland PD descend on the house, and something goes wrong, and they just start shooting at the house. I'm sure this has most certainly happened on many occasions. They shoot up the house. We don't actually see any bullet hits or anything, but we like see the house get shot up, and presumably one of the bullets penetrated the home or something. No, actually, Grandma doesn't get shot. Grandma goes into shock, and then we see her at the hospital recovering. So Grandma's not dead, but she got terrified of the sound of the Cleveland PD shooting up her fucking house for no fucking reason. So she's out of the picture for the remainder of the film. And our finale takes place at some Ohio university that happens to have a particle accelerator, which has been teased via dialogue a time or two in the script. And Bram kind of is the guy leading the charge on this plan. So the idea is, I think the kid actually says this at some point when they're talking strategy, but the idea is you can't delete data from a computer. It still exists in the computer in some fashion. It's just inaccessible. So the only way to truly be rid of the ghost in the machine is to obliterate his atoms, essentially. So they want to use the particle accelerator to just scatter his essence to parts unknown, to just completely disintegrate him, essentially. So long story short, it works. it's a very lame sequence, bolstered by a very good score. Graham Revell puts in good work for the finale sequence of this movie. But unfortunately, it has very little momentum to it. There needs to be more tension and grit to it, I guess. Like, unfortunately, the actor playing the ghost in the machine, it's just not... Maybe you could attribute it to the style of special effects they're using, but his interactions with the actors at this point are very, very limited. And because there's a kid, Karen Allen, and the Bram character, by 90s standards, it's like, really, in terms of who's on the chopping block at this point, it really could only be Bram. But he's really important to like the resolution. And plus, like, he's been kind of cozy with Karen Allen's character, who her whole story has been that she's her ex-husband was kind of shitty. So she's, I don't know, been in a rut. So it's kind of a big deal for her character to have a nice adult male presence in her life. So that seems kind of cruel for the standards of the day to rob him from her at the very last minute. So it's like you just read the room and it's like, I don't think anybody's going to die here. And if you go into it feeling that and you end up being proven correct, it just kind of feels tensionless, I guess. Long story short, they do some computer shenanigans to draw the Ghost in the Machine out of the electrical system and have him somehow inhabit physical reality, which makes no goddamn sense, but he is represented to us very similarly to how we saw in The Lawnmower Man, the ping pong ball effect, as I called it, in that film. It's like that, except it looks like jelly beans. It looks like a man made out of jelly beans. And it's some sort of graphic property or a filter or some kind of computer animation transposed onto the silhouette of the man that makes him look like a bunch of floating jelly beans all connected digitally. And he's like putting people in chokeholds, and he's putting his jelly bean essence into people's eyes. It takes a while for it to do anything, though, such that it never actually does anything. Like I said, the whole finale of this movie is pretty weak. Anyway, it ends with actually, it's basically the Alien Resurrection ending, if you remember that at all, several years before that movie would come out, but from the same studio. 20th Century Fox. Karen Allen has a revolver that Bram had, so she picks it up and she tries to shoot the ghost. It doesn't do anything to him because he's made of jelly beans. you can't kill jelly beans. So she shoots they're in the control room of the particle accelerator, and she shoots a hole in the glass. She shoots the glass, in the words of Hans from Die Hard. And at first it does nothing, and he starts to make a move on her, but then, very similar to Alien Resurrection, that one little hole in the glass allows the super magnets of the particle accelerator to reach into the control booth, and it basically pulls all his jelly beans through the window and into the particle accelerator, and then through the magic of 1993 CGI, we see him rendered asunder, and yeah, that's the end of him. And the movie ends with a dumb joke of Bram telling Karen Allen to turn off that damn machine, which happens to be a heart rate monitor attached to him in an ambulance. Cut to credits. It's like, we got to get out of here. The movie's 95 minutes long, and the last five were not particularly great, so it gets out of there in a hurry. But yeah, that was Ghost in the Machine. Directed by Rachel Talalay. It's not a great movie by any means, but I do think it's kind of a cozy watch, especially if you have any sort of nostalgia for early computer graphics and garbage 90s culture, of which there's an unending amount of when it comes to media. But I do think this is a decent example of some of the kookier aspects of that sort of thing. So this was our most recent cyber techno future shock pick. I'm not sure what's going to be next week, but I do want to get to Virtuosity at some point. That one does check a lot of the same boxes as this one, although it's probably overall the better film. Most certainly has the stronger cast. Young Denzel Washington, excuse me, and Russell Crowe, among many, many others. But yeah, that being said, if you'd like to catch up on any of our other Catching Up on Cinema content, you can find all of that collected on our website at catchinguponcinema.com. You can also find us on the social medias in the form of the Instagram at Catching Up on Cinema, as well as the Twitter at Catching Cinema. So feel free to hit me up at either of those. And the podcast is available on pretty much every platform you can imagine, including Bitcade. So fucking Google it. And that being said, thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.